All right. Welcome everybody to Masterclass tonight, August 3rd, 2023. We have a big group of presentations tonight and presenters, some recordings to go along with that too. So let's get started as soon as we can here and enjoy these wonderful presentations that are coming to us. Matthew, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Take it away.
All right, can everybody see my screen?
Yes.
Excellent. Good evening. My name is Matthew Davis. Today, I'll be presenting to you success strategies in the scope of failing forward. Our agenda for tonight will start up. We're going to stand up, and then we'll set some goals. Then we'll sit down, then we'll look at creating some SMART plans, a little history of success in hard times. First, I'd like to start off with sharing a comic strip from Nathan Planet called, Nathan Pyle called Strange Planet. Tomorrow, we awake Pre-Star for strenuous actions. A regrettable agreement. But this machine's gentle tones will alert us to rise. Ah, soothing melody. I wish to harm the melody machine. I'm sure a lot of people have a similar kind of relationship to their alarms in the morning. The writer for Strange Planet, Nathan Pyle, explains in an interview, one of the points of Strange Planet is that this, as he gestures in every direction, referring to the world around us and the comic series, is all delightfully odd. The aliens use deadpan technical terminology on a planet where they are about as technically advanced as we are, but a little more emotionally advanced. He has achieved success who has lived well, laughed often, and loved much. The opening line of a poem from Bessie Anderson Stanley, More Heartthrobs, Volume 2. I encourage you to look it up and read the rest of it. Herbert Bayard Swope, who also coined the phrase Cold War, once said, I can't give you a surefire formula for success, but I can give you a formula for failure. Try to impress and try to please everybody all the time. In just a few minutes, we've gone through 24 hours of someone's life. We started on a strange planet. We planned to do something the next day, woke up, lived, laughed, loved, and tried to please everyone. Failing forward is taking the mentality of the mentality of failure as a loss, then changing that mentality to where failure is a gain. You gain insights into what didn't work. Experience is learning from trial and error. All right, now I'd like everyone to stand up. Put your arms out to the sides and spin them kind of like wind turbines with your palms up going clockwise. This is just one of many steps from the Egoscue method. That is a good way to get your blood flowing, get your mind going. Now put your palms down and go counterclockwise. Small circles going around, little moments like that can help you improve a lot of your starting your day. So small exercises like this are a good way of starting your day and also increase your blood flow rate. All right, now I really want you to stand up. Put your arms out to the sides and bend them slowly, moving your hands into fists and resting them on your hips. Lift up your chin and head high. Say, I can. Put your heart into it. Say, I can. You're putting yourself into a position and a posture of a superhero, which when you do that and then you create your process moving forward of whatever you're going to be doing for the day or whatever you're trying to convince yourself you need to do, you're a little bit more stronger and you can increase your success rates. A lot of this is based off of some Tony Robbins stuff that I've heard. I attended one of Tony Robbins' success strategies motivational talks, and it typically starts with high energy buildups, getting everyone excited, get their blood pumping. 15 minutes alone could be spent on the buildup. For the sake of brevity, that's all we'll do for today. A morning routine mixed with grateful thinking and mild exercise is a great way to start. When you change how you think you open your capabilities up to new possibilities. When you tell yourself something over and over, you make it true. Your subconscious will try and enforce it and push your life in that direction. So change your mind, change your life. Something to make something great, you have to make something new. Create a new, let go of what was. Say this with me. The quality of my life is the quality of my emotions. The quality of my life is the quality of my emotions. So the way that you react to everything creates your own reality. You're in charge of it. That's all you. So you ask yourself, what parts of me need to grow or expand to gain an extraordinary quality of life? Fear is the cause to so many hurdles in life. People make it a complex process of, I don't know why I feel this way. I don't understand. Often it's just as simple as being afraid. What might happen? What if I fail? What if this? What if that? You must get rid of fear. If you can't get rid of fear, then use it. Turn fear on itself. Turn I'm afraid of into what if I don't? What will you be missing out on? Fear is nothing more than an obstacle that stands in the way of progress. Use it before it uses you. Find what is holding you back. Find your excuses. Excuses help us stay in that safe and comfortable spot. Be aware of the ones that you tell yourself. When you look at a problem and think you can't solve it, you are creating a self-fulfilling prophecy. Change your mind, change your life. You're likely have heard of a can-do attitude. Have one. The simplest first step is to change from can't do or won't do to can do. Put yourself in the right state of mind. Position yourself as a superhero. Fear of failure is understandable. Failure is inevitable, though. It's part of the process. Set goals. Some of them will fail. And that's okay. You'll start right back to go eventually. When we make goals that we want to accomplish but can't seem to get them done, try to consider comparing the reasoning. Are you thinking you should, or are you choosing to? Should leads to a decision, which leads to a sacrifice. Eventually, you make a decision. Saying I choose to leads to a choice, which leads to commitment. Choose to accomplish the goal. Take note in the difference between I should and I choose to. Make a starting point. Have it one that is easy, that can lead to the next step automatically for the things you want to be doing. If you continue to not succeed, maybe you're relying too much on I should, rather than your intrinsic desire to do it. Ask yourself, how willing am I really to make this change? There's something that's been around for quite some time. A bunch of different places will recommend it, and you've probably seen it if you haven't. It's really a good baseline for setting plans. They're called SMART goals or SMART plans. A SMART plan is specific, measurable, actionable, rewarding, and time specific. Set your goal with those in mind, then reevaluate it with no or yes. Don't try to use a maybe or sort of yes or no answers only. If you find that your goal is specific, great. You ask yourself, is my goal specific? And if no, add specifics. Measurable? If no, add milestones. Actionable? If no, add actions. Rewarding? If no, add values. Time specific. Be specific and concise. Include the measure and the time frame. So set action steps to achieve success. Make a starting point habit. One that is easy and leads to the next step automatically. What is the first action step you are going to take to achieve your goal? Once you get into the habit of doing the easiest part, the rest falls into place, creating a subconscious process that your brain will follow and help you skip past the, ugh, I don't wanna. Like, take your pre-workout mix the moment you get home. Then you'll feel like, well, I already took my pre-workout. Next thing you know, you're at the gym. take a look at what challenges that you have to overcome. People are always looking to avoid problems. You have to look at problems as gifts. Only people without problems are in cemeteries. Problems are a sign of life. Next, what resources and skills are needed? Find out why the goal is relevant. What are the benefits? Each of these steps of a smart plan should help you lead to your goal. The way to get started is to quit talking and begin doing. Walt Disney. When you begin, something pushes you back. Find insight as to what happened. Something hit hard. Use pain and setbacks as tools for growth. Success does not only flourish in the best of times. Here is a timeline dating back to the early 1800s, where very successful businesses started during times of economic crisis or depression. Rockefeller created Standard Oil in February 1865. That was the final year of the Civil War. Procter & Gamble came about during the Panic of 1837. Coors during the Depression of 1873. UPS and General Motors in the Panic of 1907. The Great Depression lasted from 1929 to 1939, time when many successful brands got their start. After 11 months of smooth operation, the 12th month of operations for Walt Disney Company was the market crash of 1929. Then Fortune magazine came out 90 days after the market crash. United Airlines also started operations that year. Then Revlon came out later in 1932, Hewlett-Packard in 1935. Then in the 1970s, FedEx started shipping during the oil crisis of 1973, Charles Schwab during the market crash of 1974 to 75, Microsoft during the recession of 73 to 75, and Costco in the recession of the late 70s. Most recently, LinkedIn came in 2002 during the post-dot-com bubble. Lots of these companies are very well-known or household names. All started out in times that were very hard. They pushed through. They found a way to make it. So in summary, change your mind, change your life. Everything that you look at is your perspective. You're in control of how you react to it. The quality of your life is the quality of your emotions. Your reactions are what define you. Failure is always inevitable. So set goals that you choose to do, make smart plans, and remember, history is on your side. I'd like to thank you for your time with my talk. If anybody would like to add me on LinkedIn, feel free to. If anybody has any questions, floor is open.
Thank you. That was wonderful. You actually made me get up. Anybody have any questions? Yeah, this is a good TED Talk, exactly.
Thank you, Alec.
All right. Thank you so much. That was great. We will move on to Rachel. Are you ready?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. Yep, I'm ready. Let me share my screen. Can you see my screen?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
All right. Well, hi, everyone. My name is Rachel Passell. I'm an intern in the cybersecurity department. And tonight I'm going to be talking about how social media impacts cybersecurity. So for the agenda tonight, I'll talk about some social media statistics, some of the positive and negative impacts that social media has on cybersecurity. We'll discuss some secure social media practices and then a conclusion. So let's start out with some social media statistics. According to Data Reportal, there are 4.8 billion social media users around the world as of April of this year. That's about 60% of the population, and it's growing rapidly every day. The most popular social media networks as of April 2023 are Facebook at 2.9 billion monthly active users, YouTube at 2.5 billion users, WhatsApp and Instagram both at 2 billion users, WeChat at 1.3 billion users. And if you don't know what WeChat is, it's a Chinese instant messaging, social media, and mobile payment app. And then TikTok at 1 billion users. Additionally, Data Reportal shows that the typical social media user uses or visits an average of 6 different social media platforms each month. So this widespread use of social media amplifies its impacts on cybersecurity, making it even more important that we understand its implications. So social media has both positive and negative impacts on cybersecurity, and we'll talk about the positive impacts first. So social media platforms have contributed to raising awareness about cybersecurity threats and best practices. Cybersecurity experts, organizations, and influencers use social media to share insights, resources, and tips with a wide audience. Platforms like Twitter and LinkedIn allow professionals to engage in discussions and address emerging threats collectively and in real time. Users can follow cybersecurity-focused accounts, participate in discussions, or join communities to stay informed about the latest security threats and preventative measures that they should know. You can also find cybersecurity industry associations on social media platforms, such as Twitter. The pictures show three of them that I found, including the National Cybersecurity Alliance, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, and the Anti-Phishing Working Group. Social media platforms can also enhance training and skill development in cybersecurity. Many cybersecurity experts and organizations use social media to promote and offer online courses and webinars on cybersecurity topics like network security, ethical hacking, and secure coding. Users can access these resources through social media links, learning at their own pace and growing their knowledge. Also, cybersecurity professionals will often host live Q&A sessions on social media platforms, so individuals can ask cybersecurity specific questions directly to experts. YouTube is a great social media platform for staying up to date with the latest threats and preventative measures. Some popular cybersecurity accounts include the PC Security Channel, who creates content on malware, scams, and other cyber threats. John Hammond, who is a cybersecurity researcher, and he makes videos on all the latest threats. And then there's Kit Boga, and he takes a more comedic approach in his videos. He's a scam baiter that poses as a potential victim and exposes scammers and teaches the audience about the latest trends in cybercrime, as well as how scammers operate and what tools and tactics they use. Another positive impact that social media has on cybersecurity is that it facilitates the swift dissemination of information about current cybersecurity threats, vulnerabilities, and security updates. Professionals in the industry utilize social media to share real-time alerts, research papers, and news articles about recent developments in cybersecurity. The nature of social media allows for the information to be spread quickly and for it to reach a vast audience, so that people are informed and can take the necessary precautions to protect themselves or their business. On the right is a screenshot from the Cybersecurity News Facebook page, where they were sharing an emergency patch to address a zero-day flaw in iOS and macOS. And now for some negative impacts on cybersecurity. So social media is a very easy way for an attacker to access sensitive information for an online crime, including both personal and professional data. Attackers exploit social media platforms to gather personal information and engage in social engineering attacks. People tend to overshare on their social media accounts, and they have information on there that attackers love to have, such as birth dates, addresses, email, phone numbers, and employment information. Attackers can then use this information to perform different types of social engineering attacks. Some of those attacks include account takeovers and cloning, and this is where the attacker takes over the victim's social media profile and makes posts to their profile, taking the victim's contacts or sending a message to their contacts with a post sharing a hilarious video that they have to see, or some weight loss solution, or just something that's supposed to grab their attention. The post or message aims to get the victim's contacts to click on a malicious link that may then download malware on the device or send them to a fake login screen where they have to sign in again and their profile credentials are then stolen and the cycle will just keep continuing. I see this happen all the time on Facebook where I'm tagged in a post or sent a message with a link to a video that I must see. And the account doesn't always need to be taken over. The attackers can just create a similar copy or a cloned account of a person's account just by using the publicly available information they have gathered from the target's profile. I see this on Facebook all the time too, and I've received countless friend requests from fake accounts that are impersonating my grandma. I'm pretty sure it's from all those Facebook quizzes she fills out, which may seem harmless, but actually collect a lot of information about you. Attackers will use all the information you share on your social media platforms for curated phishing attacks, as the more information an attacker can string together about a victim, the more likely they will be able to create a realistic looking email or text that you will engage with. This puts not only you at risk, but the company you work for at risk. I found a good example of this from a company called BH Consulting, which offers a red teaming service. They said one of the first things they do when performing the red teaming service is go to the LinkedIn for the company and hunt down information shared publicly through the accounts of the company's staff members. By looking at profiles, they can gather what technologies are being used in the company based on the certificates the employees have received from different vendors. With this specific client that they were doing the red teaming service for, they were able to find a project manager that listed 2 to 3 projects they worked on, which were linked back to the clients. And it turns out the company had a confidentiality agreement with one of those clients, promising not to disclose any work they've done for them. So this confidential information was publicly available on LinkedIn, and in the wrong hands, it could have been used as valuable profiling information to help launch an attack using social engineering. An attacker could have used that information to maliciously win the trust and manipulate the actions of a potential victim of that company. Attackers will also pose as legitimate companies or people that the victim knows or instinctively trusts. And again, LinkedIn is a popular vector for this. Another great example from BH Consulting of this is when they created a fake LinkedIn posing as a large cybersecurity conference. And they targeted a company's chief information security officer after he had just spoken at some conference a few months earlier. The fake LinkedIn conference reached out and asked if he would be available as a keynote speaker for their conference. And the CISO was responsive, sharing his email address and more, and he was compromised within 12 minutes. I found this to be very interesting when I was doing my research because I wasn't fully aware of how much LinkedIn is used for social engineering attacks. There are also targeted scams on social media, which I'm sure we have all seen, like cryptocurrency scams, romance scams, fake ads, job scams, lottery, sweepstakes, and giveaway scams, and many more. These kinds of scams will also typically be aligned with your interests to better target you and get you to click on them. These photos, the top one shows a message like I was talking about with a malicious link that appears to be coming from your friend with a video or whatever that you have to see. And then the bottom picture is a tweet from Barack Obama during the 2020 Twitter Bitcoin scam, where many prominent, highly followed Twitter users posted double your Bitcoin tweets, and it was discovered these accounts were hacked through social engineering attacks on some of Twitter's employees to gain administrative access to high-profile usernames and passwords. Social media data breaches are another negative impact and are also becoming more common. LinkedIn reported that in 2021, data from 700 million users had been leaked. In 2019, Facebook reported a breach that compromised 533 million accounts, and Twitter was breached in 2018, resulting in 330 million compromised users. Identity theft is another negative impact of social media on cybersecurity. With the increased global use of social media, there are more opportunities than ever for cybercriminals to steal identities and perpetrate fraud online. Most people know not to share their driver's license and social security numbers online, but many social media platforms ask for or even require similar sensitive information that can be used against you, including your full name, your date of birth, relationship status, hometown, school locations, graduation dates, pet names, and other affiliations. As millions share this information to register with multiple social media platforms, the data becomes vulnerable as attackers and identity thieves use it for malicious objectives. The last negative impact I'm going to discuss is malware distribution. Social media platforms are a very effective way to distribute malware because there is a very large user base. Constant sharing is encouraged, which can quickly propagate malicious links or files. Social media platforms often use URL shorteners to save space in posts, and attackers will hide the true destination of a link behind these shortened URLs, making it more difficult for users to identify dangerous links. And social media is heavily accessed through mobile devices, and mobile platforms have less robust security compared to desktop computers, so they are more susceptible to certain types of malware. The many different delivery methods on social media also make it effective for distributing malware, such as malvertising, drive-by downloads, digital media, shared links and images, fake software updates, fake apps and games promoted on social media, and of course, phishing. And users constantly sharing content and user profiles further promotes the spread of malware. Social media users usually feel comfortable clicking on things on their trusted platforms, and this is something that attackers exploit. So how can we protect ourselves when using social media? Some practices we can all use in our personal lives when using social media include using two-factor authentication on all of our social media accounts to increase the account security. We can avoid suspicious messages and links, either sent in private messages or posted publicly by someone who appears to be a friend on that account. We can refrain from sharing personal information, including location, and we can create strong and unique passwords that are different for each social media account. Lastly, we can review those privacy settings to make sure that your account is protected as best it can be. And as for a business should have a comprehensive social media policy that outlines the best practices, guidelines, and security protocols for employees, and it should also define acceptable and unacceptable behavior on social media. Social media training is important to ensure employees are familiar with the best cybersecurity practices to increase security when using social media, as well as teaching them the threats that are out there. Employees should be taught how to recognize things like suspicious messages, links, requests, and to avoid clicking anything from an unknown or unverified source. The weakest link in cybersecurity is humans, so providing proper training is crucial to protecting the organization. Strong authentication measures should be implemented, such as strong and unique passwords and two-factor authentication for that extra layer of security. And these authentication measures should be reviewed regularly and updated to stay current with the latest standards. Also, there should be an incident response plan in place to follow if there is a social media incident or security breach. This should establish reporting channels for employees to report any concerns or incidents related to social media. And lastly, businesses can choose to monitor their employees' social media use to protect itself from cyber risk via social media if the employee were to share sensitive information. So in conclusion, the impact of social media on cybersecurity is undeniable, presenting both challenges and opportunities. Social media platforms contribute positively through increased cybersecurity awareness, rapid information sharing, and enhanced training opportunities. But we must also remain vigilant about the negative impacts, such as social engineering, malware, and identity theft. It's important that we strike a balance between leveraging the benefits of social media for cybersecurity while also safeguarding ourselves and our businesses from potential risks. By using secure social media practices and staying informed about emerging threats, we can stay safe from those who want to exploit us via social media. And here are my references. And yeah. Thank you.
Great job. Lots of information. Anyone have any questions for Rachel?
Did I stop sharing?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, any questions? Oh, someone did.
Yeah, I've got a question.
Yeah.
You were saying that there's a lot of like social engineering attacks on LinkedIn. And so I'm somebody who's kind of looking through, you know, the jobs listings and everything like that in LinkedIn. And so is there any like advice or watch outs that you would have for that? To avoid getting bamboozled, you know?
Well, I guess really look into who you're like how the example of the people that reached out to the CISO, really check out who you're talking to make sure it's a legitimate like posting or whatever. I know there's a lot of fake posts out there too. Really check it out before you're messaging with someone or
Okay, thanks.
Mika?
So in addition to your suggestion, I would recommend if you see a position you like, you just go directly to the company's website and apply there.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
All right, yeah, thank you.
Anyone else have a question? All right, thank you.
There one for Michael Bueno. I think I forgot this. Can everyone see the screen?
Yep.
Yes.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for attending my presentation over endpoint detection and response. I do apologize for not being able to make it tonight. I had a family emergency, so I had to do a recording. Hello, everyone. Endpoint detection and response, or EDR, is a cybersecurity technology and approach designed to detect and respond to cyber threats and attacks on endpoints. Endpoints are critical components of a network, and they are often the initial targets of a cyber attacker seeking to gain access to a system or network. Through continuous endpoint monitoring and rigorous data analysis, businesses can gain a better understanding of how one threat or another infects an endpoint and the mechanisms by which it spreads across a network. Instead of remediating threats offhand, organizations can use the insights gained via EDR tools to harden security against future attacks and reduce dwell time for a potential infection. Some examples of endpoints are laptops, desktops, servers, applications, and any other Internet of Things device. Monitor endpoints in.
The audio's lagging.
Identify potential threats before they can cause significant issues. It also provides a comprehensive view into endpoint activity, processes, and network communication, which enables the security team to improve their incident investigation approach. They can also conduct proactive threat hunting to identify and eliminate hidden threats that may have evaded automatic detection. EDR solutions also provide the ability to automate responses to certain types of threats, such as quarantining files or processes that perform behavior that's deemed a threat. Like HIPAA or GDPR, And with EDR, companies can monitor for any suspicious activity and investigate the source of any potential threat. This helps organizations ensure that their company is remaining compliant with industry regulations and standards. A key benefit to EDR is the ability. While cybersecurity is a critical aspect of modern digital life, it does come with its fair share of challenges. Here are some common cybersecurity challenges that organizations and individuals face. Threats are always evolving, becoming more sophisticated, and adapting to security measures. Organizations always have a risk of employees and individuals unintentionally compromising security by falling victim to phishing attacks or mishandling sensitive data. They also face a risk of employees intentionally causing harm to the organization. Many organizations are moving to the cloud, and the biggest challenge with that is that they're relying on the vendor to secure the data since they own the cloud. It's important for companies to discuss any concerns with the vendor to ensure security is still priority for them as it is for you. There are different models of cloud security where the cloud vendor strictly secures the endpoints of the application and the organization is still responsible for the internal application security measures, such as, you know, which access, you know, a certain user gets to certain data. Another big challenge is keeping up with vendor patching schedules. I know for my organization, we were struggling finding a way to keep up with Microsoft's Linux patching cycle for Microsoft Defender for Endpoint. They require you to be within two versions of their ATP, which is Advanced Threat Protection releases, and our software rollout cycle typically took about a month and a half, where we targeted dev and test for the first 3 weeks, and then we slow rolled into production at the end of the month, which still moved into the next month. And by the time we had a version fully rolled out, Microsoft had already released a new version, sometimes two. Luckily, we were able to automate certain things that allowed us to now start testing a new version once it's released and then rolling it out shortly after. I was doing some research to give you an example of when EDR was successful in stopping an attack, but I did come across an article that described how EDR was used to sort of monitor behavior for a ransomware attack that happened back in 2017, and I thought it was more interesting, so I wanted to share it here. So in 2017, there was a massive WannaCry ransomware attack. It was a global ransomware attack that targeted hundreds of thousands of computers worldwide. The ransomware exploited a known vulnerability in Microsoft Server Message Block protocol known as Eternal Blue. This vulnerability allowed WannaCry to spread rapidly through networks by exploiting unpatched systems, even those that were not directly connected to the internet. Once a system was infected, WannaCry encrypted the user's files, making them inaccessible. The ransomware then displayed a ransom note demanding payment in Bitcoin to unlock the encrypted files. Victims were threatened with permanent data loss if they did not pay the ransom within a specified time frame. What ended up happening is a kill switch was found, which was discovered in the malware's code, which helped organizations stop the spread of the attack. So why am I showing you this attack without showing how EDR stopped it or prevented it? Well, there was a research team, a malware research team at CyberBit, which is an EDR a company. They wanted to see if their EDR tool would detect and respond to the WannaCry attack. So they infected a computer that had CyberBit EDR already running in real time. And as soon as they launched the attack on their computer, the EDR noticed the suspicious behavior and created alerts immediately. The researchers kept the malware infection running on the computer so that the EDR solution could generate a behavioral graph to identify a pattern in the process of the malware that it was taking. The behavioral graph above shows that the ransomware payload was executed and dropped several files to gain persistence as indicated by dropper nodes in the graph, which is sort of on the left side. It then initiated a lateral movement by dropping a hostname.cmd command, which you can see there in the middle of the graph. And then the ransomware then ran a command via the command prompt, which modified the registry keys. And then it hid the attributes of the dropped files by using the attrib, the attrib command, which you can see there also at the bottom of the middle of the graph. I was doing some research to give you after the attack was stopped on the Windows machine, the researchers opened the u.wannacry file for a drill-down view displaying the results of a static analysis of the file, which confirmed that it contains suspicious import functions used in the PE import table to encrypt data, which was the crypt release context, and it also modified the file time with the set file time, both imports, which you can see there in the top left image towards the bottom of that screenshot. The researchers also drilled down into the CMD icon to see exactly what was happening, which revealed that a CMD batch command was used to add the malware to the registry and to the auto run list, which is a straightforward persistence mechanism as shown in the image on the bottom right. Although the EDR tool did not stop the attack from the beginning, it did help identify a new way attackers are executing malware, which helps organizations create new rules to stop similar attacks in the future. While EDR tools provide an abundance of benefits for organizations, there are still a few things to remember with EDR tools, such as the false positive alerts that they can generate, indicating threats are not actual threats, or even false negatives, which is failing to detect an actual threat. Striking the right balance between sensitivity and accuracy is crucial to avoid alert fatigue and ensure effective threat detection. Another thing to consider for EDR solutions is that it can be resource intensive, particularly on endpoints with limited computing power or memory. Continuous monitoring and data collection may impact system performance and slow down endpoint operations. This is especially difficult when enabling real-time detection since it's always going to be running. For example, Microsoft Defender for Endpoint on Linux is an EDR solution that I'm currently managing right now. And the biggest challenge that I've been facing so far is managing the CPU utilization when other processes are also running hot. So in this example above on the right, this is an example I found online. This isn't from my workplace, but the image on the right shows a common or a command called mdatp_audisp_pl. There's another process called wdaemon, and there's one called audit-d. mdatp_audisp_pl. This is a component of the anti-malware software that monitors any system calls made by another job. So in this case, it would be the system journal command, which is the first process running there on the right. The wdaemon process, this is the anti-malware, anti-virus Microsoft Defender agent that's monitoring all the other processes. And when other processes start to consume a lot of CPU, the antivirus, anti-malware tool, which in this case is the wdaemon, it also starts to use CPU, so it can keep up with the real-time detection scanning while everything else is actively running. The same goes for Windows-based operating systems, as depicted on the image on the left. The antivirus agent is monitoring RStudio, but it's still using a lot of utilization since it's continuously scanning another software that's also using quite a bit of memory, which is RStudio, because RStudio alone already uses quite a bit of CPU while it's running. Implementing endpoint detection and response effectively requires best practices to maximize the benefits and improve the cybersecurity of an organization. Here are some key best practices for EDR solutions. Ensure that EDR is deployed on all critical endpoints within the organization, including servers, workstations, and mobile devices. Comprehensive coverage ensures that potential threats across the entire network are monitored and detected. Once you have the necessary coverage across the enterprise, it's critical to also regularly update the antivirus so that your organization is up to date with security patches. The WannaCry malware attack that was mentioned earlier was only successful on endpoints that were running an old version of Windows, and if they had been updated to the latest versions, they would have received the patch for the vulnerability that was exploited. I also mentioned a big challenge with EDR was the stress it can put on some devices, but it's still recommended to enable continuous monitoring of endpoint activities in real time. EDR should provide up-to-date visibility into processes, network connections, and file modifications to quickly identify potential threats. It's also beneficial to integrate EDR with security information and event management, known as SIEM, solutions and threat intelligence feeds to enhance threat detection and incident response capabilities. This integration allows for correlation of EDR data with broader security events and known threat indicators that are not provided with just EDR alone. And lastly, educate employees and users about cybersecurity best practices, including the importance of recognizing and reporting suspicious activities and detecting potential threats.
That was really good. Endpoint detection and response. Excellent job. He comes back to watch this. Very good. Okay. Michael Foy? Are you ready?
Hello, hello. Yep. Let me just pull up the PowerPoint. So I will try to keep this to 15 minutes. There, oops, wrong screen. Yeah.
No problem.
Can you guys see my screen okay then?
Yes.
Yep. All right.
Little background. This is just some research that I had worked on in the past. I think it's super interesting and kind of demonstrates a little bit about the scientific method. And so I am a researcher by trade. It's what's got me into data analytics. So, you know, in a way, this has helped lead me to where I'm at. So enhancing force spectroscopy biomolecules, I'll kind of go into what different things are. I'll try to keep it as high level. And then any questions you guys have, you can ask me at the end. But here in just this first slide, I've got the some pictures. So, you know, are you able to see my cursor by chance? My mouse?
Yeah, we can see your cursor.
Awesome. So up here, we got some molecules. Over here, we got some DNA, some lab instrumentation, and then kind of a little visual of what force spectroscopy is. So I will go on to the next one. So some background. There's a lot of, basically this research project involves something called DNA origami as kind of the basis. And so I have a link in this PowerPoint that I can share to the chat and in the presentation folder, but essentially it'll kind of talk about what DNA origami is. It's a very new discipline of biophysics that probably came about in the last, you know, 20 years, early 2000s. So scaffolded DNA origami consists of several kilobase pairs, single strands of DNA, and basically you can orient them and create them in a way that once you mix them together, they will create a three-dimensional structure. And so think of like normal origami, you know, take a piece of paper, you make a swan or, you know, a house or whatever. The cool thing about DNA is it folds itself. So, you know, you have all of your base pairs, A to T to G and so on and so forth. They will fold themselves. So you can make really, really, really small structures, which is really cool. We can use a CAD software to essentially create these cross-linking staples is what we call them. And then you send that off to a lab. They'll generate it for you based on the structure that you sent them. Super cool. And then this, talks about the process. You heat it and cool it to give it its shape, and then for it to bleed off, if you will, some of the weaker pairs or mispairs. And at the end, you can see at the bottom here, you kind of have these little structures. So you have the little man here that you made with the CAD software. This is what it's going to look like. You're going to get all these different base pairs of the DNA that you'll mix together. Over time, you heat them, and they will eventually become kind of like the little guy here. So this is actually a TEM microscope. It uses electrons to generate an image. So what we're looking at in these little images are at the nanoscale, so very, very tiny, but you can see, you can take something on a computer and create a small, biostructure essentially, which is really cool. Enhancing force spectroscopy. So in general, DNA kind of has a limit. Single molecules, DNA, they have limits of the amount of force that you can apply to them. So if you apply too much force or too little force, you run the risk of either getting too much noise in some of the data that you might be trying to generate, which you can't draw conclusions from that, or you run the risk of destroying the DNA essentially, or the single molecule, and unfolding it, tearing it apart, and then your experiment is ruined. And so the high level of this is essentially creating a hinge structure out of the DNA origami, the scaffolded DNA, and then applying being able to set a single molecule inside of the hinge, and then applying larger forces beyond that 60 piconewtons to that hinge to get a higher force, but it won't disturb or it won't destroy the DNA on the inside. That's kind of what you're seeing here in those two pictures at the bottom. Actually did end up making the hinge, and so that's what it looks like on the TEM. But then the conceptual drawing of it was, all right, if I can create this hinge, I could put a little hairpin in it, and I want to see at what forces I can essentially open and close this hairpin using the hinge. So applying the force to the hinge and not the molecule itself. So just getting a little more granular control over the actual experiment in such a small scale. So I will leave it at that. So preparing the experiment. The basis of the experiment is I need to be able to, one, create a hairpin, and two, how am I going to attach the hairpin to the hinge itself? And so essentially what you can see here is you have smaller strands of DNA, and then all of these little lines, different colors, are different single strands of DNA, and so we cross-link them at certain points to create this long, rope, if you will. And so I have a rope on either end of this hairpin. A lot of the experiment to begin with involved just applying the force to the hairpin so we could see at what point the hairpin opens and closes as kind of a baseline before we put it into the hinge. And so this is supposed to represent a flow cell, which I think I'll show you on the other slide. But essentially, we have a little cell that you would, the slides that you put into a microscope, created a little channel in it. And I put some DNA, essentially attached it to the bottom of the slide. And so that will allow these different base pairs to come attached to it and be stationary. And then you got your hairpin, and then this big thing up here is call it a magnetic bead. It's essentially a small little iron molecule, and it has the streptavidin, which is a biomolecule that is attached to it. And so when I mix all of this, stuff together, it will, connect, make this rope, and then the point of the magnetic bead is I need it to be magnetic because I'm using something called magnetic tweezers to apply a force to it. So kind of jumping ahead here, but this is generally, starting the experiment. This is the flow cell right here. So just I have all my different pieces and parts that were in the slide before. You know, you kind of mix them together in a certain order. You flush the cell with the stuff that's supposed to rest at the bottom, and then you kind of add each piece of the rope one by one, and then eventually you have that, you know, this. So magnetic tweezers, what are those? So I told you about the magnetic bead. So essentially, once I create that rope that has that bead and that hairpin in the cell itself, I will put it under a really, really small microscope. And so it's not a visual microscope. I'm not necessarily seeing the DNA itself. It's too small, but I can see the bead on the screen. And so what I'm doing is I'm applying this force over time to the flow cell so I can try and identify where I have, you know, a single bead and a single hairpin attached to a single rope. And I use this worm-like chain to kind of determine that. And so this is a model that is, you know, known that exists. It is for biomolecules and DNA. And so essentially at this extension, at these different extension points and forces, I can say definitively, like, okay, this is a single strand. So go to the next slide. So more on the magnetic tweezers. This is kind of the output. So you can see you can see the magnetic beads here. So I have magnetic beads and stationary beads. One of them is like sits at the bottom of the cell, which are these little, these big ones here, these silver ones. And then the magnetic beads are kind of throughout the cell. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to find individual ones. I do not see this on the actual magnetic tweezer device, but I put this under a microscope just to get like a visual of what they look like. And so I use a stationary bead as a control so I can help, like I can use that to essentially calculate out the noise of all the different movements in the cell and then get a very clean or a much cleaner read on this magnetic bead here. So I'll just go to the next slide. So the results were pretty cool. We were able to establish the baseline and we determined that around 30 to 40 piconewtons is when the hairpin opens. And so that is pretty cool to be able to do one. A lot of work to go into creating this flow cell and creating this hairpin, and then, you know, to be able to find the right force that needs to be applied to the hairpin to open it. So this is great. Now, next step is to put the hairpin into the hinge, and then now that we know like what the baseline application force is to open the hairpin, we can then use that to build on what the force is going to take to use the hinge to open the hairpin. So we know, I'll just leave it at that. That is essentially my presentation. Here's all my references. I did a lot of the groundwork and foundational work on this piece, but it wasn't without help, lots and lots of help. So I will leave it open to questions. Got about 5 minutes. No questions?
Okay. Right,
well, I'll leave it at that. Yeah. I'll put the link in the chat. You guys should definitely check it out. You know what DNA origami is. It's really cool. One thing I did forget to mention, one of my favorite parts about it, one of the reasons I got into biophysics, is because by creating this three-dimensional structure out of a biomaterial, there's like, you can make smiley faces and little robot things and hairpins or whatever, but there are some pretty, there's a high potential for some significant healthcare applications. So there's other work happening around the country, around the world to create a box, little boxes and, you know, things like that, that will essentially contain, you know, a medicine or a drug, you know, think of cancer or diabetes. If you can put it in this biological structure, you know, and it'll be a way to target, have more targeted drug application and delivery. So, you know, a little box comes, there's a little lock on the box that has a specific sequence of DNA. And once it comes in contact with something like a cancer cell that also has some kind of, you know, DNA that you know what kind of cancer it is, it'll come in contact, react, open the box, and deliver the drug directly to cancer cells. So it has the potential to be a more targeted way of, you know, something like cancer treatment. And there's a lot of other things too.
Do you ever work with RNA?
I mean, they kind of go hand in hand, but no, not I okay. don't personally.
From what I remember from high school, is that RNA, you can actually change the structure of the cell. Is that correct?
I don't know the definitive answer to that. Okay. So I focus a lot more on the physical interactions of everything. And so I know how to like grow the bacteria and harvest the DNA and follow these steps. But I am not the one who creates the DNA origami structures. I do not, I am not a biology person. So I'm more focused on like the application of the force and, you know, just if it works or not, basically, and then tell them what I need them to do different. And then they make the adjustments. So I'm not sure about, you know, the RNA question.
Cool stuff. You and Landon probably have a lot to talk about.
Probably, yeah. I was hoping he'd be here for this one, but I'll have to just share it with him later.
Yeah, tell him to watch the video and starting at about 1 hour. And it'll be there. Awesome. Yep. Great job.
Yeah, thank you.
Definitely. Okay, I'm going to do Pete Garcia. It will go on its own. Let's see. All right. Can you see the cow on the screen?
Yep.
Here you go.
Good evening, everyone. I decided to do my presentation on advancements in technology, specifically around dairy farming or agriculture. This is something that I have recently learned about, and I think it's interesting to me at least, because I feel like the technology may not be widely known. So the dairy industry has made some huge improvements since 2007. Today, the U.S. dairy industry's carbon footprint has drastically cut down to less than 2% of all greenhouse emissions. It also accounts for only 5.1% of all water consumption and takes up approximately 3.7% of U.S. farmland. Previously, to produce 1 gallon of milk in 2007, emissions were up 19%, consumed 30% more water, and occupied 21% more land in the U.S. Next slide, please. Obviously, agriculture has a great impact on many aspects, from the environment to other cows and farms, and can even have a direct impact on people. This is why some farmers are leveraging the power of cloud computing, such as the AWS platform, to increase productivity, reduce food waste, manage power and water consumption, and sustain other areas of farming. Not to mention the well-being of these dairy cows, which to me is the most important part, at least. A great example of this is Norway's largest producer, distributor, and exporter of dairy products. I believe it's Tine SA. I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce it, but we'll go with that. With over 9,000 cooperative farms, TINSA's goal was to become more data-driven and utilize predictability models. Their goal was to gain insights and better understand the well-being of the cow, the quality of their milk, and other aspects throughout their life cycle. This was accomplished by partnering with a company called Crayon, which specializes in AI and machine learning. Crayon created the cloud infrastructure and management tools that today feeds a data lake with 2.5 million data points for their Norwegian cows. In the near future, they do hope to increase this to 250 million data points. Some of these data points include details of the cow's life, such as familial data, feeding habits, health and growth trends, as well as other useful biodata. Next slide, please. Aside from cloud computing, there are robotic technologies that help owners maintain and improve their businesses while continuing to lessen their impact on the environment. One of these technologies include manure collectors. Because of the threat to the environment and the surrounding areas, as previously discussed, manure collectors can be configured for custom routes and be set up for automation. Essentially, a Roomba for dairy farms, just a little fancier and a lot more expensive. In some farms, they've even placed sensors in key areas around their fields, which collect data about current conditions to help farmers make better management decisions. Another very useful but often underutilized technology revolves around the methane produced by hundreds of thousands of cows. A methodology that farmers have recently adopted makes use of that technology to transform those emissions into usable and renewable energy sources. For example, anaerobic digesters, or otherwise known as methane digesters, utilize microorganisms and the lack of oxygen in order to feed on organic material like manure or food waste. As a byproduct, biogas or mixtures of different gases are created. Next slide, please. This byproduct can also be used for, you know, things like vehicle fuel, compressed natural gas, heat, and electricity. It can also produce sustainable materials such as fertilizers, compost, and even bedding, specifically for animals. Next slide, please. The last technology I want to talk about in terms of like robotics, those are robotic milkers. Personally, it's my favorite technology here. One particular farmer, his name is Dan Ventiker of Iowa, outfits his dairy cows with e-collars so that when they enter the milking station, information about that cow is transmitted. The system then makes a decision on whether to allow or deny an individual, which udder or teat to milk or avoid milking, and for how long. The cloud-connected system ingests all of these data points to ensure that his cows not only get milked on their own schedule, but also ensures the safety of the public by analyzing the milk from each teat for quality, health issues such as mastitis, which is what happens when a milk duct gets clogged. It also checks for quantity, anomalies, and abnormalities that may be present. The system was also smart enough to detect that cows develop the habit of wanting to get milked just so they can have a snack. So these cows eventually got rejected until it was appropriate for them to have another milking session. Next slide, please. again, the farmers that are taking advantage of cloud computing are taking all of these, all of this data from environmental data points, robotics programs, and automation. All of that data is being fed into a cloud-connected infrastructure like AWS for machine learning, transforming the industry to digital herd management systems and providing insights like never before. So since there is a shortage of cloud computing professionals already, and even more so those that specialize in agriculture, I thought it would be interesting to look into the kinds of jobs that are out there. So some of these jobs include planning coordinator with a focus in dairy production, data scientist, and data scientist with a focus in modeling, SharePoint farm system administrator, and digital farming solutions DevOps. These are only just a few positions available off of one site, but it's interesting for those that might want to combine their love of the two. That's all I got for now. Thank you for your time and have a good night.
Well, that was a great job too. I learned so much. To every week, I just got to say, I learned so much from these masterclasses. Wonderful, wonderful job. So I'm going to cut in here. I had one more that recording, but I'm going to put them down to an area where there's more time. This one's kind of long, so, and I don't want to hold everybody for too long tonight. We're already past 10 o'clock, and I'm sure most of us want to get going. Thank you, everybody, for coming. I hope you enjoyed all the presentations we had this evening. Everybody did a great job. Wonderful job. Congratulations on getting that done. And thank you all. Have a great rest of the evening.
Take care.
All right. Take care.
Au revoir.